These are rough times. How rough, you ask? So rough that even the relative roughness of toilet tissue has arisen as a question of economic and political fairness. This pressing issue is being played out in California, naturally, a state that is always in the forefront of public policy debates. Specifically, the county of Riverside is grappling with the delicate matter of tissue texture. It all started a couple of years ago when county employees complained that the one-ply toilet tissue being used was, well, rough. So the county supervisor rolled out a new policy of putting two-ply in all stalls. Employees beamed with smiles of comfort. But not for long. The county's 18,500 employees recently learned that a double level of tushy cushiness has been delivered to the toilet stalls used by the top 10 elected officials and the executive staff. These special ones are blessed with a four-ply tissue, sold under the brand name of Angel Soft. Why do these 100 or so executive-level employees get twice the softness that we do? Demanded the other 18,400 county workers. There was no good answer. A county spokesman could only say, there was a texture test, and then the facilities management department decided that Angel Soft would be utilized for elected officials and their guests. This definitely did not sit well with the two-ply crowd, which was already feeling shorted by having to take a 10% pay cut due to budget constraints. After all, every three sheets of Angel Soft cost the county a penny more than three sheets of the common tissue, so it also became a matter of budgetary integrity. This is Jim Hightower saying, good news, though. Top county officials now say that, in the interest of tissue egalitarianism, they will revert to two-ply. Once again, California has put itself on the cutting edge of social progress.
KOP, Hornsby Austin. KOP.org on the World Wide Web. Thanks to Jim Hightower for the incisive commentary and to Isidoro Lopez for the lively music. People Unite starts now.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
You're listening to People Unite, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This week, People United has an interview with Max Tremo of the Miami-based organization Take Back the Land, takebacktheland.org. The political objectives of Take Back the Land include feeding and housing those impacted by the crisis of gentrification, asserting the right of a given community to continue, or rather, to control the land there instead of wealthy developers, and building a new society based on community self-determination. Based in the black community of Miami's Liberty City, the group Take Back the Land began in 2006 with efforts by homeless people and local activists to build the Umoja Village shantytown on a vacant lot co-owned by the municipal and county governments. After the housing built by the group was destroyed by mysterious fire in 2007, Take Back the Land has since focused on moving homeless families into vacant, government-owned, and bank-foreclosed houses. Earlier this month, Max Rameau of Take Back the Land visited Austin, Texas, where he spoke at UT Austin's Center for Community Engagement, in addition to meeting local activists. During his Austin visit, I interviewed him as well. We spoke at Resistencia Bookstore on May 12, 2009. Here now is my interview with Max Rameau. You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin. I'm here with Max Rameau, who's with the organization Take Back the Land, based in Miami. And you're in the Liberty City neighborhood, is that correct?
That's correct, Liberty City section of Miami.
Why don't we start by talking a little bit about the Liberty City section of Miami?
Well, Liberty City is a long-standing black community. Of course, it didn't start out that way in the 40s and 50s. It was a white community, a lot of single-family homes there, two-bedroom, three-bedroom, I guess ranch-style homes. And then when desegregation started to take root, black people started moving out of Overtown and into Liberty City, which then became the new black community and today is the largest, most significant black community in South Florida.
Did that also coincide with white flight?
Well, I think it was white flight because desegregation theoretically meant that black people could move into white neighborhoods. But, of course, what actually happened was that when black people started moving into the white neighborhoods, white people didn't want to be there any longer. So it quickly became black neighborhoods all over again. So Liberty City, for a brief amount of time, represented black people being allowed to live wherever they wanted. But then over a longer period of time, just like many other parts of the country, meant that that just became the new black community.
And why don't you give us a thumbnail history of the economic status of that neighborhood in the post-civil rights era?
Well, like many predominantly black communities, it is economically depressed. There's not a lot of business activity there. There's a very high unemployment rate, people without jobs, and consequently there's a high crime rate because people who don't have jobs, don't have income to support themselves and support their families, then have to resort to whatever they need to in order to get food, get housing for both themselves and for their families. You know, not having a job doesn't mean that you no longer have to eat. It just means you have to have different ways of getting that income. So there is a high level of street-level crime that occurs there. There's also a lack of government services, lack of government accountability, and, of course, there's a lot of overreaching police presence there. So there's a lot of police brutality, arrests, false arrests, et cetera.
Now, what your organization has been doing recently is rather transparently organizing squatting, and in a way also kind of regulating it, too. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the housing crisis in Miami-Dade County is considered, has been considered for some time, to be the worst in the United States, meaning that the prices of housing have gone up significantly while wages have remained flat or even dropped in many instances. And the number of people who need low-income housing far surpasses the number of units of low-income housing that are actually available. This was bad enough in the late 90s and the early 2000s, but then as this so-called housing boom took root, it really exploded in Miami-Dade County. All these condos went up. The prices of housing sometimes quadrupled in certain neighborhoods, which meant that people who could afford some place to stay a few years ago or were having trouble affording a place to stay a few years ago suddenly couldn't afford anything anywhere. And during this time, government officials were far from alleviating the crisis, were actually exacerbating the crisis by destroying public housing units instead of building more when we needed more and destroying low-income housing units in general. So consequently, we had a lot of people who had no place to stay, all kinds of government inaction, and there was actually a lot of government corruption around public housing and low-income housing money, where there was a pot of money that was supposed to go to low-income housing, which was instead being stolen, spent on artwork, and spent on politically connected people who weren't building anything, rather than developers or programs to actually build low-income housing. So on October 23rd, 2006, Take Back the Land seized control of a large lot, vacant lot of public land, and we built a shanty town, a full shanty town. We built shanties, wooden structures, where we housed 150 people in all, roughly 50 people at a time. And the Emoja Village shanty town, as it became known, stood for 6 months and 3 days before it fell to a fire. But there we housed people, we governed ourselves, made the rules around our own land, made the rules around our own village. And that's really what we had. We had a small village, a small city that we ran ourselves. And that's how we got into the practice of instituting our own public policy. We needed housing for low-income people in our community, and instead of asking the government, who had proven its own reluctance to do so, we did it ourselves.
Are there any suspicions about the fire?
Are there
any suspicions about the fire?
Yes. Well, the government tried on many instances, both the city of Miami and the and Miami-Dade County, in many instances tried to get us removed. They tried to coerce us. They tried to intimidate us off, but we weren't going anywhere, and we had an incredible amount of community support. And, of course, there were the one of the reasons why we chose that particular lot was the government was about to give it over to a developer so that for free, by the way, so that they could build condos there. So there were people with direct financial interests as well as political interests in removing us from that land. So there was a lot of suspicions around it. Of course, when the fire happened, we tried to defend our right to stay on the land, and immediately they arrested 11 of us, and they bulldozed the entire property. As a result of the bulldozing, there was no investigation into how the fire actually started. We know whose room the fire started in. We know that person disappeared after the fire, and we know that person a week after the fire was driving a relatively new car, but we don't know obviously exactly how the fire started or if anyone was paid to start the fire.
Now let's get into the next step here.
It's after the Shantytown experiment that you then began this new process of squatting?
Yeah, well, the same conditions which existed in October 2006 persisted well after that, even after the fire. And the same logic which we used to say that we need to take control over land in order to provide housing for people remained in effect even after the fire. So starting in October 2007, we began identifying vacant government-owned and foreclosed homes. We enter them, inspect them, do a little bit of fixing up of them, and then we move homeless people into people's homes. And we've been doing that since October 2007.
Elaborate a little bit about what that's been like.
Well, first of all, I think just as a starting block, as a starting place, we think that housing is a human right, that by virtue of someone being a human being, they have a right to housing. And everyone has a right to housing and should have housing. And I think that housing right now in the society is a commodity that can be bought and sold and used in any way that the owner, in this case banks or big corporations, feel that is necessary. But we believe that housing is a human right and that everyone who is a human has a right then to have a decent place that they can live, that they can afford to live in, even if they can't afford to pay anything. And right now, the problem, of course, with this is that no one can get rich, no one can become a billionaire by giving housing to people who don't have any money. Which is exactly why it needs to be a human right, and it can't just simply be a commodity. We have a very bizarre housing crisis in this country right now, where generally when you have a housing crisis, it's either because there's a lot of houses and there's not enough people living in that community, in that town. People are either leaving or not as many came as people thought as a planner thought they would. Or there's a housing crisis because there's a lot of people in a town and not enough housing. Here we have a situation where there's a lot of empty houses and there's a lot of people with nowhere to stay, but somehow the two can't seem to meet each other or match each other up. And we think, because we think housing is a human right, we think it's immoral to have vacant homes on one side of the street and homeless people on another side of the street. So we match up the vacant homes with the homeless people. And if we have to choose between the right of a human being to have housing and the right of a corporation to have a profit, particularly those corporations just got billions of dollars of our bailout money, then we're going to fall on the side of the human being's right to have housing. So we're moving in people who don't have anywhere else to stay into these homes so that they do have a place to stay. And it really not only helps the individual family, but in the end it also helps the home and it helps the community in which they're being moved into.
I understand that you've been talking to the neighbors of the house in which you want to put a family to squat.
That's right. So when we go into an area, again, we're in addition to helping the individual family, we also want to strengthen the communities into which these families are being moved into. And we don't think that these communities are strengthened by having vacant homes there. We think they're strengthened by having other families there who care about the community and who the community cares about them. So whenever we move a family in, we go and we talk to the neighbors. And we don't always, we always tell the neighbors that someone is moving in. We don't always tell them that they're squatting a foreclosed home. But we do tell them they're moving in. We do require of the people who are moving in to be good neighbors. Tell them, look, you can't, you know, make all kinds of noise. You can't disrupt your neighbors. You have to say good morning, good evening when you see your neighbors. We want you to make friends with your neighbors. And our families do that. And in that way, it really strengthens the community. You have one less vacant home on the block, and you have a good neighbor there who everyone gets along with and who they become a contributing member of that community.
Talk about, a little bit about what happens when you don't have families placed in these vacant homes.
Well, I think a few things happen. One is it destabilizes the community as a whole. Because when you have a street, which we have many in Miami, that have four or five vacant homes in it, that does not make for a coherent neighborhood. You have people who are moving out. It just destabilizes the community. In addition, the homes then become places where people still are going to squat anyhow, but because they have no real status there, don't feel that they have a status there, they have a disincentive to keep the place up. And in fact, have incentive to do just the opposite. And so you have people who don't have any money, don't have any work, but need money, who then go into these homes that they don't have any particular attachment to, and they can take out the copper wiring, so they can sell the copper, they can take out the plumbing, so they can sell the metal, they can take out fixtures, so they can sell the fixtures. And so it deteriorates the house. It also obviously brings some street-level crime into the community by people taking things out of there and then possibly seeing something at the neighbor's house and stealing something out of the neighbor's house. So we think that destabilizes the community and adds elements in the community that people don't want. Conversely, if we have a family there who's living there and they know they're going to stay there, they have no interest in taking out the copper wiring because that would just deprive themselves of electricity. They have no interest in taking out the plumbing because that would deprive themselves of the ability to use a bathroom indoors. So what we found is that when we move people into places, the places that we move them into stay in better condition over a longer period of time than those places that are vacant. We had one home in particular that we moved the family in, and the real estate agent came by and found them. Of course, we gave the family the option that, you know, they could either leave or because they received an eviction notice, or would be willing to fight for their right to stay there. The family had been there for several months. They saved up enough money, so they were ready to move. And they moved. They put their deposit down. They went to another apartment. Since then, we've gone back to that house many times. It's been vacant now for 7 months or so, and the house had been broken into a number of times. The bank was required to replace the entire almost front room, all the windows there. They probably spent close to $10,000 just doing that. And inside the place was just the windows all around are boarded up, and the back door had to be reinforced. Inside there's probably $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of damage. So by having families there, the property maintains over a longer period of time. It actually would have been better for the bank in terms of that particular property. It would have been better for the bank to say to the family, instead of you leaving, we want you to stay there. We'll pay you $200 a month just not to destroy the property. The bank still would have come out on top if they would have done that, rather than letting the place go sit empty for 7 months and get completely destroyed.
And in this case, it seems that some of the houses are coming out better as a result of having people there.
Well, yeah, the house came out a lot better, at least for the period of time that they were there. But now that they're gone, the house obviously declined very, very quickly. So it's in a real way, it's a win-win-win situation. It's a win for the family, a win for the community who gets a family in there, and it's ultimately a win for the bank who owns a property because that property gets maintained over a longer period of time. There is no winner having a vacant home. No, none. You have families who don't have anywhere to stay, your communities are destabilized, and you have a bank who's about to get its asset diminished.
I understand that the families who have moved in have then set up arrangements with the electric and water companies to begin paying bills there?
Well, we have developed a series of criteria around both the homes that we move people into and the families that we move into the home. So around the homes, they have to be in good condition. This has to be a move upward from the street, which means the capacity to have electricity and the capacity to have water. The home does have to be either government-owned or foreclosed. We don't move people into individually-owned homes. We only move them into foreclosed or government-owned homes. And as far as the families, we only do families, not individuals. But we also require the families to have the electricity and the water on and running at all times. So we don't want people living there, particularly with children, and there's no electricity or there's no running water. So this, along those lines, we have turned down more families than we've helped because the families have not been able to get the water turned on or the electricity on or whatever. So when the families move in, we do require them right away to contact the electric company and the water company and put their deposits down and get the electricity and the water turned on and then to maintain that over the time that they're there. So they do have running water, they do have electricity there, and that is one of the things that we require of them.
And I also understand that you screen people out if they have had a history of drug use or mental illness.
Right. So we, again, one of our objectives is to strengthen the community that they're moving into, and their ability to strengthen the community is dependent on them being a good neighbor. And the having mental health issues or drug addiction then would limit their ability to be a good neighbor. And to contribute positively to the community. So therefore, we have not moved people who have those issues into places. With that said, this is something that we have wrung our hands on. We're not comfortable making the decisions. We have not been comfortable taking that line, but we do feel that it's necessary to do in order to meet our broader objectives. We do feel that every human being has a right to housing. And if there are drug addicts, such as, for example, George W. Bush, who was a drug addict apparently for many years, and he had the right to housing, then I think that poor black families who have drug addicts, drug addiction in their family or mental health crisis in their family, they also deserve to have housing as well. So we don't think that we have the right to deny people that. At the same time, because our capacity as an organization, Take Back the Land's capacity as an organization, is so limited, we feel like there's only a certain amount that we can do, and this is the way that we've chosen to implement our own public policy. Our program does not help everyone, but it is helping a certain group of people who would otherwise be homeless.
I was wondering if you could maybe place what your organization is doing in the context of other squatting, organized or otherwise nationwide?
Well, there are many other organizations which are now picking up the idea, and some have started many years ago in New York. There was a movement in the 70s to take over apartment buildings, and that happened in some limited extent, but it happened very successfully there. Right now, just so it's clear and so no one is under any kind of delusion, squatting is absolutely rampant throughout the United States right now. In some states, it's more than others. All over Florida, Ohio, California, Nevada, absolutely rampant, because for a very simple reason, not because we're saying that people should do it or because someone else is saying people do it, is because there's empty houses and there's people who don't have anywhere to stay. And this is a simple mathematical, you know, equation. People need a place to stay, and they see an empty house, and there's no reason for them to sleep outside when there's an empty house there. When that happens on individual levels, though, there's not always a checks that can be checks and balances that can be put in when an organization does it, and with a clear idea of what it is they want to accomplish and how they want to strengthen communities. So we think that this kind of thing happening on an organized level is much preferable to it happening on an individual level. So we're implementing this on the organizational level, and it has started to pick up with some other groups. ACORN, which is well known for its nationwide organizing, is doing something similar with its homesteading program, where it's defending people who are in foreclosed homes, defending them against eviction. There's also other groups. The Economic Human Rights Campaign, which is based out of Minnesota, is also doing the same thing. They're moving families into foreclosed homes. There's a couple of small groups who have contacted us in different parts of California, and there's a group in Ohio that apparently is doing the same thing as well, who's contacted us. In addition to those moving people into foreclosed homes, there are also people who are defending their right to stay in their foreclosed homes, whether they are the owners or were renters and are trying to stay because they didn't do anything wrong. They were paying the landlord like they were supposed to, but the landlord didn't make their payments. So they're fighting for their right to stay there as well. And I think these efforts are becoming increasingly organized. And I think what's happening is people are recognizing a certain amount of lack of logic in the current land and housing system, where you can have a bunch of places that are sitting empty, and the government is paying these banks to keep these places empty, but it's not providing the same level of support for individuals who need places to stay. And I think this society has to decide, is it going to support human beings who need housing, or is it going to support a corporation's right to keep housing vacant just so it can maintain a profit and profit level that it wants?
How long has Take Back the Land been around as an organization?
So we started in the summer of 2006 because the housing crisis in Miami was really exploding and became completely out of control. And a number of other organizations in the area were doing great work around the housing issue, but a lot of the work was predicated upon the government solving some of these problems. And we believe that the government was largely responsible for these problems. And so it seemed like it was a kind of a dead end, a logical dead end anyhow, to go ask the same entity that was largely responsible for the problems in the first place to then be largely responsible for solving the problem that they created in the first place. So in the summer of 2006, we formed a small decision-making group, which was an all-black political decision-making group. And we hashed out some ideas and thoughts, and ultimately those ideas and thoughts manifested on October 23rd, 2006, when we took over a piece of land and ultimately built the Emotion Village.
Tell us a little bit about your own background, Max Ramo. What were we doing before Take Back the Land?
So I've been a long-time community activist, mainly around issues of police brutality, but also around immigrant rights, refugee rights, particularly Haitian immigrants. Also done a lot of work around the rights of the LGBT community to not be discriminated against and to have full rights and be recognized as full human beings in the society as well. As well as work on other kind of housing issues, public housing, mainly the right of people to have public housing and to remain there securely. I was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and when I was at a very young age, moved to Washington, D.C., where I was raised, and then moved to Miami when I was a young adult, and I've been living in Miami for about 17, 18 years or so.
So how old were you when you moved from D.C. to Florida?
I was 21 years old.
Support for Co-op comes from Oceana, a musical celebrating magical stories of the sea from around the world. playing at the Vortex from Saturday, May 9th through Saturday, June 6th. VortexRep.org or 478-LA-VA. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This hour, People United is featuring an interview with Max Rameau of the Miami-based organization Take Back the Land, takebacktheland.org. Asserting the right of a given community to control its own land, Take Back the Land is currently challenging the crisis of gentrification and affordable housing in Miami's Liberty City by moving homeless families into vacant, government-owned, and bank-foreclosed houses. Liberty City is a section of Miami, Florida, with a population that is over 90% black. During his recent visit to Austin, I spoke with Max Rameau of Take Back the Land at Resistencia Bookstore on May 12, 2009. You'll next hear us talk about black self-determination and the prospect for alliance politics. We continue with my interview with Max Rameau. You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
Getting back to Liberty City in Miami, how would you tie your organization's efforts to the goal of black self-determination?
Well, we are the Take Back the Land is not a homeless organization, and we are not a housing organization. We are fundamentally a land organization. And more than that, we are an organization that believes that the black community must control the land in the black community. So we're explicitly a black organization that deals with the control of land in the black community. So the work we do is around Liberty City and Little Haiti, which are both black communities. That's where our base is. That's where we feel like our center of power is, and that's where we do our political work. So when we took over the land in Liberty City to build the Emotion Village Shantytown, we did it openly and clearly, saying that we have particular needs in Liberty City, the black community does, and we don't want developers and the elected officials who do their bidding to come in and say that they're going to build condos in our community. We don't need condos. We need low-income housing. And so we took control of the land so that the black community could decide what happens on our own land. And we think this is a significant point in the context both of gentrification, which has been happening recently, but also in the context of segregation, which has happened historically. In the 50s and 60s, when there was segregation, the larger white community was able to say to us that we could only live in one particular segment, or one particular area, section of town, and that's where we're forced to live without any concern what our own desires were. And during the recent crisis of gentrification, which of course is low-income people being forced out in order to make room for higher-income people, black people often being forced out to make room for whites or lighter people. The recent crisis of gentrification, we've had large numbers of black people moved out of their historic communities and their current communities in order to make room for other people. In either instance, the black community has not had control over where we live, and we have not had control over where over the decisions that matter for our community. And we want to change that dynamic. In that respect, we really haven't had much progress. When people talk about progress since the civil rights movement, we really haven't had much progress, because in either instance, we didn't have control over the land, even though the way it manifests itself in terms of segregation versus gentrification is slightly different. So we wanted to control the land in our community, and we feel that we're doing that by taking over land and using it for the needs that we have in our community. And that applies both for vacant land and for improved land, such as housing, public housing, or foreclosed housing.
What alliances have you been able to set up with other organizations, not just for blacks, but for other communities of color?
Well, we think other communities, communities of color and white communities who have these kind of issues and problems should form their own organizations and join in coalitions with organizations like ours that deal specifically or explicitly with the black community. So we believe that all communities have the right to control the land upon which they sit in. And there are some communities which are multiracial, and there are some communities. But the fact is, in this society, we have high levels of segregation, even if not legal, de facto segregation. And so these communities have cultural and racial components to them. And these groups have the right to control their land and to decide what happens with them. So we think that Latino communities have the right to determine what happens to them politically, economically, and socially, just as black communities have the right to control ours, and just like white communities have the right to control theirs.
So have you formed any alliances with other community organizations battling gentrification?
We have. We formed community alliances with other organizations who want to fight gentrification, and both organizations doing work in different black communities in Miami, but also different Latino communities in Miami, as well as different white and Latino communities in other areas in the United States outside of Miami. And we've gone into many communities, just like we're here in Austin now, to talk with groups about the way that they would combat displacement, and that they would deal with housing and land issues in their communities as well. And we think this is good use of coalition building and good use of cooperative work, is when communities come to one another from positions of strength, from positions of decision-making power. The fact is, the black community cannot come in a real coalition with a larger white community, because the larger white community is better organized, the larger white community is better funded, the larger white community has, generally speaking, a higher skill set than the black community. Therefore, there's no real coalition we can have, because there's no equal, we can't make an equal contribution. So we have to first build the organization inside of the black community, and then we can join a coalition with other communities who have similar levels of capacity.
Why can't you do both? Why can't you be building your organization while at the same time being part of a larger coalition?
Well, we are building our organization, and while we're building coalitions, we're just careful about building coalitions with unequal partners. We don't think that you can, in terms of coalition theory and organizational theory, it's very difficult to have a coalition with two extremely unequal partners. So, for example, it will be very difficult for us, a small organization, our total annual budget is about $3,000. We have no staff. We're all volunteer. We cannot be in an effective coalition with a huge organization with 100 people on staff, and it's a nationwide organization, and they have a multi-million-dollar budget, because their capacity to do things would far outstrip our capacity. We could not then operate on an equal plane, and therefore would make very little sense, whether that was a black organization or a white organization. It would make very little sense for us to join some significant strategic coalition with them, even though we could probably do some minor tactical coalitions. We couldn't be in a real strategic coalition with them, because they would be able to dwarf our capacity, and therefore our power inside of that coalition will be completely minimized.
Would you be worried about community interference?
Wouldn't I be worried about
community interference, that they would be coming into Liberty City and taking over?
Well, we certainly couldn't have a coalition based on a large number of white people coming into Liberty City in order to fix Liberty City. We couldn't have a coalition based on that, although we do have lots of whites who come who support our organization and come in, and under our direction, we're able to say, these are the things we want to accomplish, and they're able to say, well, how can we help you do that? And they follow our political lead and support the work that we're doing. So we do have that, and we'd have good coalitions in that sense, but we couldn't have a big coalition of a bunch of organizations coming into Liberty City trying to fix Liberty City. One of the problems that we have is a problem of self-determination, making decisions for, having the ability or the capacity to make decisions for ourselves. And that's good decisions and bad decisions. There are plenty of communities that make bad decisions for themselves, and that's part of being grown people, and that's part of being a community that can make your own decisions. So we want to be able to make decisions for our own community also, and that decision can be threatened by, for example, wealthy developers who come in, and they have staff, and they're highly trained and have high levels of expertise, and they have a lot of money they can give to politicians so they can have their decisions implemented. Well, we don't have that capacity to do that. We can't really enter into a meaningful coalition with developers who have economic interests and whose capacity far outstrips ours.
Well, certainly developers are one thing, and then large nationwide organizations are another. Getting back to the prospect of partnership with wealthier organizations that share some of the same goals. Mm-hmm. Have there been instances where nationwide organizations have directly come into local communities and interfered with what one of their coalition partners was doing?
Yes, we have had that. We haven't had that so much with Take Back the Land, just because we're very careful with the coalitions that we enter into. However, I've been, community activist for many, many years, and we've had a number of instances where we've entered into coalitions with larger groups, whether they're larger social justice groups or unions or whatever group, and they've been able to dwarf the capacity of community organizations, real grassroots community organizations, and therefore their agenda was the one that won out. So we had one case in particular where we had an anti-globalization protest happening in Miami, and we had a lot of organizations who obviously had an interest in opposing globalization and were protesting against it. So several community organizations joined into that, some with no staffing, some with some staffing. And then organized labor came in, and they had their own interests, and there are good reasons for interests, and interests, by the way, which we support, but which were slightly different than those of community interests. And the unions were able to come in and say, okay, we'll sit down at the table with you, we'll discuss our needs. And then the unions were saying, okay, we're going to join this coalition. We have staff. We'll provide the press people. We'll provide the research people. And we'll provide the spokespeople who will go out and talk to different community groups and organize things. And as a result of their capacity to do that, we didn't have the capacity to do that. We couldn't provide press people and all these other things. And we couldn't provide meeting spaces because we didn't have an office. As a result of that, the unions who then offered these things and had this capacity to do that then completely dominated the messaging. And when there was messaging that either they didn't agree with or they didn't consider a priority, they were able to minimize that messaging or eliminate it altogether. And they were able to do that because they were in complete control of all the staffing there. So it wasn't until this group kind of separated itself and created its own grouping, which the unions were not a part of, our message was able to come out as distinct and distinctive from the messaging of the unions. So that's not to say that we disagreed with the message of the unions, just there were some instances where the community had some interests which were different or unique or distinctive from those of the unions.
Now, getting back to what you were talking about developers and the cozy relationships they seem to have with local politicians, what's the relationship been like between Take Back the Land and City Hall in Miami?
Well, we haven't had a real relationship with them. Part of our model is that we're not dependent on, or we don't really put a whole lot of stock in, our ability to either get meetings with elected officials or influence legislation or work with elected officials or people who are in seats of power. Our model is to figure out what the capacity of our community is and then to maximize that capacity. So when elected officials come to us and say, we want to meet with you, we want to talk to you about what your demands are, what your goals are, how we can help you, we tell them we're not interested in meeting with them. And we're not, because we're mainly interested in meeting with people from our community and figuring out how we can enhance the capacity of our community and maximize the capacity of our community, not in how we can influence, you know, particular things that the elected officials do. With that said, there's plenty of organizations that do that, and they should do that. I think that's an important role and probably the central role to play in the social justice movement, but that's not Take Back the Land's role. Take Back the Land's role is to do things independent of that existing power structure, and that's what we do. So after we do these land takeovers or housing takeovers, our goal then is not to go talk to the elected officials or talk to the banks about how we can work together with them to resolve this problem. Our job is to go over and take over another house or another piece of land.
It's time for another great co-op raffle. That's right, the heat and high gas prices are upon us, and co-op is raffling off another scooter from Scooter Revolution. One ticket for only $10 or three for $25. You'll get your chance at winning a 150cc Moderna scooter and a second prize of an improv comedy course at the New Movement. Get your raffle tickets now by visiting koop.org or by dropping by our offices at 3823 Airport Boulevard. The winning names will be drawn on the 4th of July. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This hour, People United is featuring an interview with Max Rameau of the Miami-based organization Take Back the Land, takebacktheland.org. Asserting the right of a given community to control its own land, Take Back the Land is currently challenging the crisis of gentrification and affordable housing in Miami's Liberty City by moving homeless families into vacant, government-owned, and bank-foreclosed houses. When he was recently in Austin, I spoke with Max Rameau of Take Back the Land at Resistencia Bookstore on May 12, 2009. You now will hear us talk about Take Back the Land's efforts in the context of the current economic crisis. Here is the conclusion of my interview with Max Rameau. You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
So, to what degree is what you've been doing a symptom or working in tandem with larger housing crisis?
Well, we think the larger housing crisis is symptomatic of a much, much bigger problem, and that much bigger problem is the land relationships that exist in this country, individual relationships to land, corporate relationships to land, and government relationship to land. And that's just the problems with those relationships are just manifesting themselves now. So where someone can come in, a corporation can come in, buy a bunch of housing, do a little work on it, then flip it for twice its value to people who actually need to live there. That is not a sustainable model. Something that economic model can't last over a long period of time. So what's happening now, I think, is as this economic crisis deepens, we're headed towards a severe social clash, where you're going to have a clash of ideas about how we solve this economic problem, not just for the economic problem, for the bigger, you know, the more fundamental problems that the economic crisis represents. I think we head into a social clash where we have two competing ideas which are running up against each other and causing that clash. On the one side is the idea of the right of human beings to have housing, and on the other side of the clash is the right of corporations to make a profit. And those two ideas are running up against each other with increasing force. And it seems like the two are increasingly mutually exclusive, where if everyone gets a right to housing, then that minimizes the ability of corporations to make a profit. If corporations are allowed to maximize their profit, then it minimizes the ability of everyone to have housing. This society has to decide how it's going to deal with this clash of rights, and that happens on many levels. People have to decide if you have a clash between one person's right to free speech versus another person's right to peace and quiet, how does it resolve that conflict? And the same way this society is going to have to resolve this conflict between the right of housing and the right of corporations to make profit. Take Back the Land asserts that the right of human beings to have housing supersedes the right of corporations to make a profit. And we're putting that concept into play by moving people into these vacant homes, because we're saying that they have a greater right to this house than the banks have to the same house.
What have your relations with the police been like during this effort to move people into vacant homes?
Well, you know, this crisis is impacting large numbers of people, particularly in Florida, which has been South Florida has been the epicenter of both the housing boom and now the housing bust. So consequently, the police, quite frankly, probably don't have the time to go around and look for everyone who's squatting in every single house. So there's tens of thousands of vacant homes in South Florida, and if the police could literally do nothing else. They couldn't investigate murders or robberies if they just went around to every empty house and tried to clear out the people who were squatting in them. So right now, the police have taken a position where unless someone is complaining, specifically the property owner, which is a bank, which is generally not even in the same state as the actual property, unless a property owner is complaining that they're not doing anything about people who are going into those places and moving. Now, if someone's going there and they're taking out fixtures, things like that, the police find out about it. Of course, they arrest people for stealing. But in terms of just simple trespassing because they have a place to stay, because they don't have any other place to stay, the police are not doing anything like that about that. And I think that's also a political calculation, recognizing that you have a severe housing crisis now, and the people who caused the severe housing crisis are not getting arrested for their role in causing this housing crisis. So it wouldn't make much sense, it seems, or would seem very heavy-handed if then you take the people who are trying to solve the housing crisis by moving people into housing and you arrested them instead of arresting the people who caused the crisis.
So have any banks or other property owners reported squatting to the police?
Well, they have. We've had communications with several of the banks because there's a couple of the takeovers which have happened openly for one reason or another. But none of them have apparently demanded any arrests. The police have not made any arrests, even though they've been out to a couple of our locations where we have people. And, of course, they're very aware of what we're doing. What we're doing is out in the open, we're not hiding it. Obviously, we conceal the locations, the precise locations, except in a very small number of cases where it made sense to talk about the locations, but generally we don't reveal the locations. And the police, again, probably don't have the time to go around looking for where people are here.
What have the communications with property owners been like?
The communication with what?
Property owners.
They've generally, you know, I mean, I haven't talked to them myself personally. We've had other groups do it on our behalf, but generally the banks have been surprised, and then they said they were going to call back, and we really haven't heard back from any of them since. So I think it's a combination of things. I think that one is they're not sure what to do, but I think even if they are sure what to do, they don't know how to do it because they don't have enough money to go and again move out everyone who's squatting in every one of their vacant homes. I don't think they could afford to end squatting right now.
And if they did, there might be other people there who would then steal the copper and other such things.
Right. It's not clear, even then, it's not clear that them ending squatting in that instance would benefit them in any significant way.
This really,
this thing with the vacant houses really is a no-win situation, where it doesn't, obviously doesn't help families who don't have anywhere to stay, obviously doesn't help the communities, but this doesn't even help the banks. The banks are not winning having these vacant homes either. And right now they're just hanging on to this idea, I think, that they have the right to own these places and therefore do whatever they want with them. But that's not really benefiting them financially. And it's not going to be too long before their own shareholders say, look, this doesn't make any sense that you're holding these empty houses when you could be renting them out even if for $200 a month. We'd be making a lot more money than we're making right now.
You've been doing a lot of national media compared to other local community activists fighting gentrification. What has the impact of national exposure on everything from Good Morning America, Democracy Now, and the Fox Business Channel? What kind of effect has that had both on you as well as your organization, Take Back the Land?
Well, the biggest impact it has is given us the opportunity to go out to different cities, including Austin, and talk to people who are interested in this idea, whether they're going to implement it, they're just interested with struggling with the ideas in an abstract sense, even if not in a practical sense. So it's given us a chance to raise these questions and talk about them in an in-depth way. Of course, it's also given us a chance to meet with people in different cities who are considering doing the same thing or who are actually doing the same thing in their cities on one scale or another. The real impact it's had on our organization has been, myself, I've been out of town because of speaking of this, so it's limited and impacted our own capacity, our own organizational capacity. That's the only real impact that it's had on us as an organization.
What groups have you had a chance to meet with during your stay here in Austin?
In Austin, we had a an event with the University of Texas Community
Center for Community Outreach.
Center for Community Outreach, thank you. And then met with, earlier today, met with a group of several different organizations who are talking about housing issues, gentrification issues, displacement issues, just so that they can figure out, not as one group, not as one organization, but just so they can figure out their own orientation towards the whole, this whole series, those myriad of issues. So it hasn't been where we're going and talking to one organization trying to convince them to do this kind of work. In many communities, the housing crisis is not so severe, the foreclosure crisis, rather, is not so severe that these solutions could work in their communities. And the point here, of course, is not to implement one size-fit-all solutions into different communities, but it's to get people thinking about land relationships and how those land relationships manifest in their communities and how they can fight for greater social justice and for more human rights in those same communities.
Right to housing and community self-determination.
Yes, right to housing and community self-determination. That would, in the way that plays out in different communities, is different than the way it plays out in our community. And the way different organizations relate to that is different than the way our organization relates to that as well.
Now, I understand that you have a book out.
Yes, so we have a book called Take Back the Land, Land, Gentrification, and the Emoja Village Shantytown. And it's out, and it describes both in a narrative sense but also in a political theory sense about what happened, what are the things that happened that led up to building the Emoja Village Shantytown, what happened while we were there, and what happened right after the fire as well. Of course, the book is it's called Take Back the Land. It's available on Amazon as well as on our website, takebacktheland.org.
So, Max Rameau, if people want to get in touch with you and your organization, Take Back the Land, how can they go about doing that?
Well, the best way is just go to our website, which is takebacktheland.org. It's all one word, takebacktheland.org, or to just email us at takebacktheland@gmail.com. Those are really the best ways to get in contact with us.
Any closing thoughts, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think we're entering into a period where there's going to be incredible social change happening right now, like right in our lifetimes, which is not going to be unsimilar to the social change that happened during the Civil Rights Movement or after the Great Depression or many of the other significant pivotal moments in history. And we all have an obligation to participate in that social change. And history is going to judge us both as a society but also us individually on where we stood during these difficult times. So I implore people who care about social justice to join the social justice movement, join an organization, whatever organization matches your ideas about what a new world would look like. Join an organization that is fighting for the kind of society that you want to see. You must be a part of an organization so you can be part of the solution, not just standing on the sidelines or being a part of the problem.
What opportunities do you think exist now that didn't exist a few years ago in terms of realizing social justice in general and also in terms of the goals and objectives for your own organization?
I think a few years ago it would have been very difficult to set about taking over vacant land or even vacant homes and saying that this is a this is something that we should be doing. And yet now more and more organizations are either doing it or thinking about doing it. We'll be doing it very soon. This is an opportunity which clearly was not available, and where we're challenging traditionally held beliefs about land relationships, both by individuals and by corporations. And that was not an opportunity that was available that long ago. In specific terms, for our organization, it means that what we're doing, we would not have been able to do the same work 5 years ago. It's just now that this idea is emerging, and it's becoming more and more accepted by a larger group of people. So this was a fringe. This is an idea which was not conceivable a few years ago. In just the past couple of years, it was a fringe idea, and now is headed more and more towards a legitimate option for many, many people. So I think that's a significant change. I think it's going to continue to go in that direction.
What makes it less fringe now than a few years ago?
I think because the crisis is so severe. We're talking about a severe crisis, and the fact is, if everyone has housing and there's plenty of beds available in the homeless shelter and there's all these social services available for people, then no one is going to be talking about taking over vacant foreclosed homes. Yet when there's a severe crisis and there's all these empty houses and all these people with no place to stay, then suddenly that comes into play. And I think in the third world, this kind of activity has been going on for many years, many decades, because the conditions there were so bad that in those countries, the conditions were so bad that people were left with very few options. Well, now the conditions in the United States, like it or not, are beginning to mimic those conditions in many third world countries. So consequently, the action that people take to solve those problems, to address those conditions, is going to be very similar that people of those that people in those countries, those third world countries, use to solve their problems and address those issues.
Max Ramo, I want to thank you so much for coming and sitting down with me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
Underwriting co-op says a lot about your business. As a co-op underwriter, you join a community of people who are passionate about public radio. When you invest in co-op, you're investing in a valuable service that informs, educates, and inspires. Co-op Community Radio has the ears of Austin residents. They're curious, creative, intelligent, and active in the community. To find out more about joining the co-op community by becoming an underwriter, go to koop.org or call 512-472-1369. That's 472-1369.
Hey, 9, can I borrow your lawnmower?
Sure, it's just over here in the garage. Let me get the door. There it is.
Wow, looks like it's time to do a little spring cleaning.
Yeah, I have this old car in there that I don't know what to do with.
You should donate it to Co-op's vehicle donation program.
Well, how's that work?
You call 877-750-5667, that's 877-750-KOOP, and they'll haul that old clunker away. You'll get a receipt to use on your tax return, and Co-op gets a little cash. Plus, you'll have lots more room in the garage for all that stuff.
I call 877-750-KOOP, and they take care of the rest?
They sure do, and your donation helps Co-op.
Do they take boats, too?
They do. Why do you ask?
Well...
You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. A moment ago, you heard my interview with Max Ramo of the Miami-based organization Take Back the Land, takebacktheland.org. We spoke at Resistencia Bookstore here in Austin, Texas on May 11th, 2009. By the way, what I had called the Center for Community Outreach during our interview is actually UT Austin's Center for Community Engagement. For more information about the Center for Community Engagement, you can visit utexas.edu/diversity/DDCE. We now go to a regular commentary from Rahul Mahajan, who this week reflects on Guantanamo and American culture. Here now is Rahul Mahajan. You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
At first glance, the debate over the fate of detainees if or when the prison at Guantanamo Bay is shut down is simply a meaningless theater of the absurd. After all, one can see politicians on both sides of the aisle, opinion leaders and cable news talking heads, who've obviously watched too many summertime blockbuster movies, and seem to believe that these men have superpowers which would enable them to magically escape from supermax prisons in the United States and wreak death and destruction across the country. They have ample grassroots support for this, coming from a combination of the most idiotically reflexive, not-in-my-backyard mentality, and a perception from the right wing that there's potential for political gain here, and that their shock troops should be thrown into the battle. There are voices of sanity. When this whole issue first came up months ago, liberal bloggers were out in front, as they often are, explaining that closing the prison did not mean letting the detainees go, a misrepresentation the right wing has been very fond of, that domestic supermax prisons would be just as secure as Guantanamo, that they couldn't corrupt their naive, idealistic fellow inmates because they'd be on 23-hour lockdown. Eventually, some Democratic politicians screwed up the courage to repeat the obvious. While conservatives like Max Baucus and Ben Nelson have been happy to repeat the nonsense of Republicans, Dick Durbin, Dianne Feinstein, and Carl Levin have all bucked the NIMBY trend. King of the influence peddlers John Murtha happily followed, salivating at the thought of federal funding to build a supermax in his district. Even so, the fact that this has become an issue at all would be shocking if we were not also inured to this kind of nonsense by now. After all, this controversy has nothing on the war on Christmas. On more reflection, however, I think that the controversy is actually important because it illuminates some of the most detestable things about American culture. One, of course, is the extreme stupidity of so many of our political debates. This is most noticeable on the Republican side, where there's a self-sustaining complex of utterly cynical, self-serving ideologues, profoundly ignorant politicians, and a large public constituency that loves the idea of going through life without a new thought ever violating their minds. Indeed, it's gotten so bad that conservative intellectuals, those few that have any principles, are deserting in droves. But the right has no monopoly on stupidity. Witness the main argument the liberals give for closing Guantanamo, that it makes us less safe because it creates more terrorists. Of course, it is true that every one of the loud, flashy crimes that we committed early in the war on terror contributed to the atmosphere of resentment and anger that is key to jihadist recruiting. Among them, let's not forget the invasion of Iraq or the first assault on Fallujah. In Iraq itself, that last had more of an effect on the population than the Abu Ghraib torture photos. On the other hand, Americans seem to be completely unaware of the level and nature of coverage of these crimes in the Arab world. People there see pictures of civilians killed by drone strikes, testimony from former detainees, stories about treatment of prisoners in Bagram, all the things that are so easily forgettable here. Closing the prison at Guantanamo may make some small statement, but potential jihadis know what a minuscule piece of the whole picture it is. Oddly enough, their opinions are not formed by the highly constrained debate so popular in the United States. Even more fundamentally, though, the debate epitomizes the deeply American value of reflexive certainty that we should never even risk paying a price for any of the crimes we commit. The real issue over detainees is not the fate of those who are convicted of terrorist acts, but that of those who cannot be convicted. Instead of patting ourselves on the back for being willing to entomb them in living death on the U.S. mainland, we need to address our actual obligations. Generally, we release prisoners who we think are guilty, but whom we cannot convict. Apparently, that is unthinkable in this case, even though undoubtedly many of them are innocent and others guilty only of attacking foreign troops occupying their country. Barack Obama wants to institutionalize the war on terror as a permanent part of our politics by articulating a policy of preventive detention. The alternative is to let go of our reflexive desire to smash anyone who might conceivably pose a threat and attempt to offer amends. It might even make us safer in the long run. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
The Empire Notes of Rahul Mahajan, our regular feature on People United. You've been listening to People United, the show in solidarity with people of the world. This week, People United featured an interview with Max Rameau of the Miami-based organization Take Back the Land, takebacktheland.org. Next week, we are live in the studio with a panel of guests talking about the U.S.-Mexico border. Again, our regular commentary is by Rahul Mahajan. I'm Alan Campbell. Now, coming up at 2 o'clock on KOP Hornsby Austin is Texas Politics Today with Deese Eckstein and David Kobrowski. People United goes out with Sharon Jones's rendition of an old Woody Guthrie standard. Stay tuned to Co-op Radio.
land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulfstream waters. I tell you, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to KOOP, Hornsby, Austin, FM 91.7 on your dial.
Henry River opens for the righteous. Henry River opens for the righteous. The river opens for the righteous. And 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 the river opens for the righteous.
I am a pig.
And the river opens for the righteous right here on KOOP, your community radio station, 91.7 FM on your dial and streaming live over the internet at www.koop.org. You're listening to Texas Politics Today every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. Central Time, hosted by DSEX and David Koborowski. This is DSEX in the studio with you as always, and David Koborowski here with me bringing you the latest information, insight, and inspiration about Texas state, local, and national politics.